My name is Phil Hamner. I have been the senior pastor at the Overland Park, Kansas Church of the Nazarene for almost 16 years. And when I arrived, I'm going to tell you a little bit about our story. It's a very different church than it is now in a lot of ways. And so we'll just begin some snippets of the pictures you see there that kind of identify what our transformation has been like. So the story of this congregation is that it was 50 years old in January of this year. So I laugh because I was 10 months old when it was planted. So that's sort of my story with this. When it was planted, in an area that is at 91st and Lamar in Overland Park. So at the time it was planted, 95th Street was the end of paved roads. It was gravel roads and farmland pretty much south everywhere in that area. So it was on the outskirts of the city, but today is, you know, really in the heart where Overland Park extends down to 200th Street, I think. So it's a pretty dramatic change. So I want to talk about just first our location, our context, and our history. So our location is that we're in Johnson County, Kansas, which is one of the wealthiest counties in all of the United States. The median house going up in Johnson County is somewhere in the neighborhood of $700,000, new homes going up today. Our congregation was planted on the edge of where the newest and best houses were at the time. Today they're still pretty pricey houses, but they're small in comparison to the new ones that have grown up around the area. We're on the edge of development, and now we're in the middle of a suburban transformation. And that transformation is taking shape with renewal in the heart of Overland Park, but also a transformation of housing from longtime owners, you know, 40, 45 years, to new families and people moving into the area. Next to or adjacent to the church are a bank of apartment complexes on the west and also across the street to the south, condos and then houses to the east and to the north. So in terms of businesses, we are about two blocks from a business area, which is the main thoroughfare through Overland Park, Metcalf Avenue, with everything from car dealerships to restaurants to grocery stores, so a fairly close proximity to all of that. Our context is one of ethnic transformation. When I was a seminary student, I came to this church, and that was 25 years ago. It was an all-white congregation. When I came back 16 years ago to pastor, my wife and I noticed immediately there were a large number of Hispanic folks working in various places around the area, restaurants, hotels. That was our first sighting. My wife is a missionary kid, so she grew up in Nicaragua, and she pays attention to that quite well. So we noticed that and began thinking immediately, what exactly does that mean for us? When it was planted, it was a neighborhood church. When I arrived, it was a drive-in church, which is pretty common in Overland Park. Most Nazarenes will drive past several Nazarene churches to go to the one they've chosen, and which means there was very little neighborhood presence around the church. When I was a student 25 years ago, there was a family that lived directly across the street, two or three others that lived within two blocks of the church, and no one else lived there. And that's been true for probably the last 25 years. So that transformation has created this dilemma where the congregation never really discovered who was in the neighborhood as this transformation was taking place. The DNA of this congregation is that it is a church plant out of Kansas City First Church. In its early days, the role of charter members is outside of my office, and it's a who's who of Nazarenes. There were in its planting, they weren't all general superintendents at the time, but five of the charter members became general superintendents. It's had a very strong and vibrant connection to the seminary through the years. So I have pastored six or seven seminary professors or retired professors over the 15 or 16 years that I've been there, and then scores of seminary students. Outside of that, there was a large number, as you would imagine here, a large number of folks who worked in the General Church or the District Church or at Mid-America who were connected to the... So it was a very Nazarene community and a very professional Nazarene community. It's generally been white-collar with very little blue-collar employment. That's changed with our immigration transformation and the ethnic transformation in the neighborhood. We recognized in that first year that we were here that we had no idea who lived within close proximity to the church, so say 2 miles in any direction. We learned quite quickly that more than half of the people that lived within 3 miles of the church were unchurched. They had no connection to any religious community. And that's surprising because there are so many churches in the proximity to our church. We're catty-cornered to a Lutheran Missouri Synod church. There are Presbyterian and Methodist and Lutherans within 3 blocks in almost every direction. But we recognized that what we needed to do was we needed to discover who our neighbors were, and we needed to discover how we might connect with our neighbors. The first task was a task of willingness. Are we willing to really do the hard work that it's going to take to discover this and to discover in the process who we might minister to? But even more than that, we began to discover our own need to do this work because we had not been the church that we were intended to be because of that. That's the context. That's just a brief introduction to the context. If you have questions, I leave something out that you want to know, just ask. I'll try to provide that for you. Our history is, edge of the city, the heart of the community. It's historically had great preachers and pastors. The founding pastor was Millard Reed. Following Millard Reed was Wayne Sharps, whose son David pastors College Church here. Following that, Dennis Johnson, who became a district superintendent in Tennessee and a successful pastor in multiple places in the U.S. Following him was Randall Davey, who was the pastor when I came to seminary, who was a great preacher and an excellent pastoral care pastor, and who lit the fire under the leadership of some mentors for worship and liturgical renewal within the congregation. Following Randall was Dan Berg, who was a professor of theology at NNU at some point in his history and came to the pastorate out of the teaching assignment. Following him was Mike Jackson, who teaches preaching and homiletics at Tribeca Nazarene University today. And then me, who had large shoes to fill coming in intimidated by all these big figures, but found it a very welcoming environment for a young preacher. I was only in my mid-30s at the time, so I was a little green, having only about a decade or so of pastoral experience before I came. It always had a missionary heart. That is, it always saw itself wanting to help others overseas. So it had a sense of a strong calling to that, and has been a church that has funded missions in a very strong way, funded work and witness trips, funded the building of churches through Alabaster. It is Compassionate Ministries. It's done that work. Strangely enough, it lost the ability to see its own community, you know, in proximity. So that became a major part of who we are. Our history is a long and strong connection to the seminary, as I said, with multiple professors, multiple administrators, support staff, and students who've just been a part of that church through the years. But there was this challenge of who we were. Who were we supposed to be? When I arrived, I hadn't been there for about 5 or 6 years because I was pastoring somewhere else, and I walked into the building, and the first thing I thought was, this building looks tired. I bet these people are tired because the building had run down. They hadn't cared for it. They needed major renovations to be done. The children's wing was dark, kind of dank, and really old carpeting that, you know, you wouldn't want your kids crawling around on that stuff. And in fact, I found out in my interview and in the process of getting to know the church, they really didn't know who they were. And they were really struggling to identify that. So what they immediately did as a decision before I arrived, but was a good idea, was to launch the Alpha Course. You're familiar with the Alpha Course? It's a evangelistic tool that is developed out of an evangelical Anglican community in London. And it takes you through a process of video teaching by the pastor in London and around a dinner table with people that you invite, and they come to your table. The idea is you invite unchurched people to dinner and conversation, and then there'll be a leader who is typically not a pastor. In fact, my job was to stay quiet for most of this. But lay people who are hospitality and lay people who might guide and conduct conversation out of the teaching part of that. We launched that right away, and that began to energize a recognition that there were people that we knew that didn't know Christ. I don't know why that was so surprising to us, but it was. And so it was a very exciting time for people to begin to rediscover that. In the midst of that, the identity crisis was really coming to a head, because people would say, okay, I've gone through the Alpha Course, now what am I supposed to do next? The idea, bring your unchurched friends, took time. And we had to keep doing that for about 5 years to get people connected to that. In the second year I was there, we launched something that I'm going to talk about in just a little bit that helped with the transformation of my community. All right, observations that I made, that we made together. We discovered that our neighborhood had changed right under our nose and we didn't even know it. We discovered our neighborhood was ethnically diverse. You could see that when you walked into a McDonald's or a local hotel or a restaurant or a grocery store, because there were employees that were ethnically diverse. But no one imagined that they were actually living in close proximity to the church, typically in the apartment housing or townhomes that were near the church. And so that surprised us. Again, it's kind of silly that it all surprised us, but it did. We discovered we did not know our neighbors, nor any way to really connect with them. And we discovered the ethnic diversity was not immediately obvious, as I said. I put this picture here. This little boy, his name is Elias, and he's not a part of this, but his story is a great one, and I just wanted to tell it, so I put it in. But his parents are young adults. His dad was a student of mine at the seminary, and has a very strong heart for missions. His grandfather is Charles Gailey, who taught missions at the seminary for years. Elias was born, had a twin, and the twin died the day before he was born. And Elias was taken by emergency and had a stroke, a series of strokes after, at the time of his birth. He kind of charts for me the remarkable move of our congregation from a crisis mode into discovering how wounded and lost we were and who we were, into this beautiful story. His parents have worked with him in remarkable ways to take a boy who they said would never walk to where he's walking, talking, playing like a normal kid. And the other point I want to make about this is that the work we were doing to rediscover the community in a missional way drew young adults like his parents into the community. They were excited by this, and so that's drawn people in to be interested in what we're doing. We discovered that we needed help to understand our neighborhood. So we had to have experts or people who could help us analyze what we were seeing. So, you know, we go to all the places that we knew. By the way, my presentation is very inductive, because this is sort of how we fell into this. I don't think we're experts at this, because we're still making lots of mistakes. But it is a sense that this process is how we thought through it, okay? So we went to Dale Jones and the research people at the Global Ministry Center and asked them for some data about our community. And it was just on the verge, because the census was late. I mean, it was about time for another census kind of thing. And the new data hadn't come out yet. And so we didn't know all of the ethnic transformation of our community. But obviously, we discovered lots of Hispanic people were in the area. What we jumped into eventually was the Chinese community that we had no idea was there, but I'll tell you more about that later. We discovered that we needed tools to learn who our neighbors were. About the time that we were doing this, Wes Eby, who was a member of our congregation, and who had taught English as a second language as part of his professional career, he and I had a long talk in my first year when I was driving to Indiana for Thanksgiving. We just talked for about 2 hours. And I said, this is what I'm seeing, Wes. And it was really his vision to say, what if we began to teach English and see who might come? And so we had no expectations but to teach English as a means to connect with people in the community. We discovered that we would need a very long period of time. I mean, in the life of a church, years to really discover what we needed to do. And typically, we want immediate results really fast, and so we had to be patient and discover that. We discovered that we weren't the ones who picked the mission. This has been said multiple times in the last 2 days. God has the mission and we join it. So this was our eyes being opened to who God was leading us to. So here's our plan. We decided we needed to develop a ministry focus that would... Yeah.
In this discovery process, how did you do the congregational meetings, think tanks, observation, walk-in neighborhoods?
Good question. The initial was anecdotal. So, like, we started with Wes and I having this conversation and saying, okay, now we need to talk to the board about this, that we would do this. And we began to then pull other people in individually to say, hey, this is what we're thinking. What do you think? So you sort of talk to individual board members and leaders before you actually propose this to sort of prepare them for that conversation. We then proposed this as it would become the primary focus of Wednesday night ministries. So children and youth would be going on, but they would be prepared to receive children of families who were coming to learn English, which mostly meant, you know, kids learn a language a lot faster than their parents do. So most of these kids were fairly proficient in English, but not all of them were. So we had some hiccups with that. It meant then that we centered our discipleship ministries at other times in small groups and gave a lot of attention to teaching English. And if we had Bible studies on Wednesday night, they were geared also for English language learners. From there, I think we did that, and we talked to the congregation about this change, and we engaged them to be a part of that process. When we did that, what we discovered were there were people who would never volunteer, never be involved in any activity, especially evangelistic or outreach oriented, who thought, well, I could sit down and help somebody learn how to read the newspaper, or I could sit down and talk to someone in English to learn conversational stuff. They didn't need to know the language because there were lots of different languages that would be spoken by people that were coming in. And then the other thing we also did was we began to help people learn how to apply for jobs, learn how to keep a bank account. We even helped students prepare for a citizenship test to be U.S. citizens. And we've had several students go through that process as a part of what we're doing. That gave people who were very timid about evangelism, very timid about outreach, a place where they could begin to work with people in one-on-one relationships. And there was no pressure because we said, we're teaching English. That's all we're doing. That was our initial goal. And so there was not this, you know, high pressure, try to lead someone to Christ through a language barrier that was just almost impossible to overcome at first. Does that help you understand kind of how we got to that point? I would say then we went from that into stages as we went along, and maybe that will become clearer as I go. But initially it was selling leadership and key lay leaders to be a part of this. And yeah, and then you just sort of go, which was a seven-year process.
7 years.
To get, we've been doing this for almost 15, and it was a seven-year process to get to where we began to see evangelistic efforts turning the corner. So it was a long time of relationship building. So our ministry focus was English language classes. It still is. Why did we decide on that? Well, we decided it because we thought any ethnic group that would come to an English class would benefit from that, and it would be a very low bar of expectation for them if they had nervousness about coming into a church. Remember, we would have Muslim folks who would come. We would have folks from the former Soviet Union, so generally atheists or non-believers. We fell into the Chinese community, which is mainly mainland Chinese, who also live in a culture without the church really being strongly present. And so we did that because it gave us a way to touch everybody. It also gave us a way to build relationship without a lot of pressure on anybody, but just to learn customs and ways of life. And it helped us to learn who our neighbors were, because those classes, I call this section the wilderness journey, because we really for 7 years had no idea what we were doing. We just kept doing it until we got better and better at what we were doing. And then we began to get a vision once we got more confident in what we were doing. So 15 years ago we started. We initially started with this, and we pretty much do this now: beginner, intermediate, and advanced. Well, what we've done here is we've split these off. So the beginner is a class that is for people who have virtually no English. And so they're learning letters, they're showing pictures and saying cat, dog, you know, doing that kind of thing. Here, it's tailored to the needs of the student. So often it's one-on-one tutoring now. It's not a big classroom setting too much. And in that setting, then, we'll find out what the student is interested in, what their needs are, and then we go to work to find somebody to fulfill that, right? We learned that slow and steady relationship building would be the way to do this. We did it through class interaction. We did it through our students and teachers deciding on their own. They would share meals in each other's homes around significant cultural events in their lives. So most immigrants to this country want to know about American customs. So all the American holidays, which includes Christmas and Easter, and the opportunity to tell the gospel story in those settings, but also to tell about, you know, American holidays, Thanksgiving, things like that. That became a significant part of what we were doing. We knew that was a long-term process. We didn't know how long this would take. The sharing of cultural customs was really important because the largest group that we had were Chinese. 85% of the total number we have are Chinese. And East meets West means that in many ways, Western thinking would be the way to think about it in an Eastern mind is almost exactly the opposite. And so there's a great level of confusion that was existing between us trying to understand our Chinese friends and them trying to understand us. It gave us the opportunity to share food customs. I mean, You needed to go. If you went to a Chinese house, you needed to go and not having eaten for about 3 days, because they would just overwhelm you with food, and it was a wonderful experience. And it was a very growing experience for us. We began then to get away from the nervousness of this diversity to begin to celebrate it. And people in the church would go to someone's house and learn about a food, and then they would try to make it in their house and then share it with their friends. And I mean, it just became that kind of a thing. We began believing that our students first would be Spanish language students. And we did get lots of Spanish language students. But over the 15 years, we've had 19 different language groups, the largest of which are Chinese. And the single reason why the Chinese community became known to us was that an Anglo member of my congregation had a Chinese businessman friend who came in town periodically, and he would come to church with him. And when he learned that we were teaching English, he said to his friend, "Well, can I tell the church? I have this mailing list of 250 households, Chinese households in the community here, that probably would like to know about this." Right underneath our noses was this large Chinese community looming. Most of them, almost all of them, are highly trained professionals doing medical research, PhDs and MDs of all kinds, doing major medical research at KU Med Center, at UMKC, at a variety of places like that. But we also had students from Eastern Europe and the former Soviet bloc. We had students from Africa. We had students from Asia, Southeast Asia, so Filipino, Japanese, Korean, Vietnamese, and Cambodian. We had folks from the Middle East. We've had Iranian students speaking Farsi. We have had Muslims from Africa, and also we had a group from Cameroon, where they speak French, and a predominantly a Roman Catholic country come and become a part of the classes and then learn a bit more about our church and eventually join our church. But our primary culture group were Chinese and Taiwanese. So if you know anything about mainland China and Taiwan affairs, these are bitter enemies for the last 60 years. And so we had to walk very carefully through this process. 7 years on, when we began seeing people converted to the faith, we would give them opportunities to share their testimonies. And on one particular Sunday, we had a Taiwanese woman who gave her testimony, and she said her name, and she said, "I'm from the country of Taiwan," which created World War III among the mainland Chinese, because it's not a country, it's part of their country, from their mindset. So it was like a political crisis that developed for us. And we had to learn on the fly how to negotiate all of these very challenging scenarios. So we also learned that the cultural and relational sharing goes both ways. So you know Americans, they think they go to any other culture, they're going to save the day and rescue everybody, right? We had to learn that we had a lot to grow into learning other cultures and other ways of life, and that that would benefit and value us in the life of the church. Lastly, for several years, we just learned about them and we shared about ourselves. Then we began... Oops, too fast. We began to do things like this outside concert. This is an all-Chinese choir that came and performed. It's actually a bigger group than this. This lady here, Christina Ye, is now a pastor in our congregation and serving in multicultural ministries. And it was her choir that she organized and brought into this. She is a fantastic evangelist and community liaison. And she developed relationships with all these folks. They began to come and perform. We would have Chinese New Year events. We would have all kinds of events that began to grow us and grow them together. So I'm going to launch into what we learned and then what we implemented. We learned that culture requires patience and forgiveness. There is so much about our culture that horrifies other parts of the world. And there's so much about their culture that terrifies us, that we had to learn to grant space for forgiveness and understanding, and we had to learn to be patient with the cultural distinctiveness. We also learned that if we were patient, it would reap joy in our community, because the patience would lead to the deepening of relationships, lead to people coming to Christ and finding faith. Our first convert and baptism was 7 years after we started English language classes. 7 years. And that person was converted and baptized and then immediately called back to China by her job. And so we had to celebrate the event and prepare her as best she could when she went back. And we did that, but it was like then the ice kind of broke and things began to change. And in the next 3 years, I baptized 40 Chinese. In the midst of that, there was a Chinese house church meeting in Overland Park that had gone it alone for years. And the lay leader of that community felt he no longer could manage the community, and they wanted to be a part of a community. They heard about us, and they came and met with me, and there were 25 of them, and they said, if it would be okay, we would like to join your community. And so we sat down with them, and we had a nice conversation about things. We talked to our church, we welcomed them, but Excuse me. It was a rather lengthy process of learning how this would work. So that was about 5 years ago. What we learned very quickly was that we needed a liaison between our first language English speakers and second language English speakers. That became Pastor Christina. How she came to our community is she moved from Taiwan. She was a Presbyterian pastor in Taiwan. She moved here to take care of her parents who live here. She came to our English language classes. She began to get involved in the church. She and her son and daughter joined the church. And then it suddenly dawned on us, we have a pastor here who could help us. And that's exactly what we did. We began the process of building relationship with Pastor Christina, inviting her to join the Church of the Nazarene, which we did, and which she did, and she's now an ordained elder in the Church of the Nazarene. And that process enabled us to have someone who was immediately in context and contact and could help us understand what we were not understanding about seeing and hearing what we needed to hear. Sorry. All right, so we also learned these things. We needed to cultivate a sense of belonging and investment for Chinese and other immigrants who had joined our community and began to move from classes to Bible studies to corporate worship. So we had to think of ways to do that would bridge the communities and begin to move them. So we've done really basic things. When scripture is read on Sunday morning, scripture is projected in Chinese on the screen. Or if scripture is read in Chinese, it's projected in English. We do as much of the worship service together as we can, and about 25% of the Chinese are proficient enough in English, they will stay in the English language community. The other three quarters go to a separate room where Pastor Christina preaches from the same text that I'm preaching from, but on a different level of experience. We learned that we needed to expand our ministry to include support groups, fellowship groups, and recovery groups. Why is that? Most of the time, when someone moves here, it's for work. And in the community we were working with, that was the case. So what we found was that the professionals would have the social interaction to develop in the community, but the spouse and the children were always left kind of to the side, especially a spouse, particularly wives, who didn't have any contact in the community. And so just providing social activities for them to begin to integrate and understand and connect, which meant support groups, which meant fellowship groups. And on at least three occasions in the last 5 years, a spouse will move here, typically a husband, for a job, and the moment he sets foot on American soil, he divorces his wife and leaves her basically homeless and stranded. And that has happened in, not all in the same culture group, but it's happened in three separate occasions. And we scrambled to figure out how to help that person to survive, finding jobs for them, housing for them, cars for them, transportation, that kind of thing. So recovery groups, not in the same way we would think of recovery groups, but small groups of people who would work with that particular individual to help them to cope with the transformation the catastrophic transformation that had happened in their lives. We learned also that the more and more advanced we got in teaching English classes, what we really needed was one-on-one tutoring that was designed by the student to address their specific identified needs. So we would have, this is not uncommon for us, we would have a medical doctor who was also a PhD doing high-level research at KU Med Center coming to have English classes because they didn't think their English clearly wasn't good enough for them to communicate with their American colleagues. That was really, I think, humbling for them and nerve-wracking for us because these are brilliant people. These are not people who are not intelligent. These are people who just need help over that curve. And I remember one day I was at the gym, and I was getting ready to get on a treadmill, and I looked over, and one of our students was there. And she was a medical doctor doing medical research I think, on influenza. And she was on the treadmill walking, and I looked to see what she was reading, and she was reading James and the Giant Peach. Anybody know that story? It's like a second grade story for kids to read. But this was how she was engaging in the language in order to build her fluency. And so that's the kind of things that we started to do. And each student, some students wanted to just simply read the newspaper and talk about it together. So we found that there's an ESL newspaper that talks about current events. We ordered subscriptions, got 50 of them, had them available. We had textbooks. Students were studying for citizenship exams. We were helping some students prepare. We tutored one student to pass their medical boards here in the U.S. They were medical doctors where they were, but they weren't medical doctors here, and they had to pass a separate set of boards. So we did all of those things as best we could. What we discovered was that over time, we could make overtures, slowly but surely, to spiritual questions. And when they simply wanted to read, after about 4 years, we began to suggest, well, here's a book that we really like, the Bible. Let's read this together. And so we'd get a very easy reading translation, and they would use that. And over time then, I said from year 7 to about year 12, was this rapid transformation and growth in the community to where people were coming to faith, people were joining the church, people were being baptized, and really joining the community in a substantial way. We knew that we needed a multicultural worship experience, but also to have specific language offerings beyond the main worship service. So we have ELL Bible studies that go on multiple times during the week and on Sunday mornings. And we have, like I said, the two preaching times, Chinese and English. When we have communion, which is about every 3 weeks, we have a communion booklet that we use that follows a ritual, and on one side is English, the other side is Chinese. So we all come back together for that, and then we share this together. And then we began to develop an idea that for every Anglo serving in the church, a teacher, even board members, other ministry positions, we wanted to invite a Chinese brother or sister to join us, or one of the other ethnic communities that has stayed and be a part of the church, to join us in a shadowing, mentoring way so that we could share ministry together and develop lay leaders in all the communities that we were serving. Where are we today? 30% of my congregation in the middle of Johnson County is Chinese or Taiwanese. That is a rapid, massive transformation in 15 and a half years. It makes us, in the middle of what was once all-white community, it makes us a multicultural church. When you get to the 20 to 25% threshold, you're considered that. And so we have a large number of Chinese on Sunday morning. We have a Taiwanese pastor responsible for multicultural ministries, who has gotten a voice of her own in the Anglo community to energize Anglos to minister and evangelize Anglos. She's not just thinking about her own community, but she's thinking about English speakers who are here and born and raised here who don't know Christ. And we've learned to celebrate our unity and our diversity. This is not without headaches and pains. As recently as last fall, a long-time member of the church came in on Faith Promise Sunday when we had missionaries from China speaking and saw an all-Chinese choir and got mad and left and said, I want to go to a church that's American. And they were gone for about 6 months, but his wife said, I'm not leaving this church. And he's a bit of a cantankerous sort anyway. So he just sort of gruffed around. And I've noticed for the last 6 weeks, he's in worship again every Sunday. So we've had those kind of hiccups, and we still do. We have miscommunication and misunderstanding in the Chinese community and in the American community. We have all kinds of misunderstandings. But we've kind of come somewhere where I could never have dreamed that this would be what I would be doing at Overland Park. I had another vision for what I'd be doing when I was there. I'm going to stop and let you ask questions. Yeah.
You mentioned that some of the people moved back to China. Have you heard any kind of update on how they transitioned from the context in Overland Park back home?
Well, because we have a missionary couple in China from our congregation, and because Rick Power, who's a DS in Hawaii but also directs our ministry there, because he, his sister is in my congregation, and I've pastored a good portion of his family through the years, we've had connections that way. Some of my seminary colleagues are missionaries in China. So we've had a lot of knowledge, and we figure out, if at all possible, who we know who's near where they're moving to try to connect them. Now, it's a very large country, so it's very hard to do. But there's somebody who you generally know somebody else who could help with that. And that's been a blessing. One story I should tell you is that, you know, China has changed their one-child policy now. They've lifted that. But before they lifted it, it was a very serious issue. So we have families who have 2 and 3 children, but have stayed here. We had one family that the wife was pregnant with the second child, and they were having to return because she was employed by the government. And she essentially hid out in an apartment in the basement of someone's home until she gave birth to the child. Once the child was born in the U.S., the child's a U.S. citizen, could get a U.S. passport, and would not raise when it came back because the child would then live with the grandmother. Well, now that family's reunited because the one-child policy's lifted. So we've had ministry like that as well that we've connected to. And our people are staying in touch with folks there. We have to be very careful. I talked to one of our missionaries. In fact, I'll talk to him on Thursday morning by FaceTime or Skype. And every time we talk, we've learned a code that we can talk that doesn't betray what he's doing and doesn't get him in trouble. Because multiple times early on, we would start talking, and we would discover that we'd be cut off just immediately. And so we had to learn how to get around that.
You mentioned the one story of the gentleman who got upset. How was that transition for the bulk of your congregation? And I know you took 7 years, which is an amazing amount of time to be able to take to do that. How was that transition for the majority of the
Because English class training would require as many as 50 people to be involved, a lot of the church was involved on the ground, which enabled us to reduce the anxiety because they were involved in what was happening. So this was no surprise to them, and this was wonderful to them. Typically the ones who would get worked up are typically fringe, but enough invested that they wanted to have a say, or people that just simply weren't involved. You know, we all have them. They've been in the church forever, but they just really aren't involved in the ministry of the church, and anything that changes what they've always known creates anxiety for them. And that just, it took probably a bit of one-on-one with them, pastoral care, to sort of help answer their questions. I still know that there are some people who just don't really like this and wish it would go away. But we just feel like that would be a grave sin, and so we're not going to do that. And we've just tried to continue to help people. I mean, I've learned to have a sense of when I think we're moving too fast to try to back it off a little bit, so we're just always trying to stay reasonably centered in what we're doing. But sometimes I'll get it wrong, and I'll discover, oh, we've gone way too fast for both sides. They're not connecting with this at all. One of the things we pushed too hard was to train Chinese brothers and sisters to be elected to the church board as they were being discipled into the faith. And we did it too fast. And they got into a system that they didn't understand, that we inadequately trained them for. They had no sense of church, because they had grown up in a country where this didn't really exist except underground. And so they had no sense of being connected to this community above all else. What typically happens to a new believer? You baptize them, right? In the Chinese community, mainland Chinese, they come to faith, they come to the table, but they won't be baptized immediately, because when, as they say to me, when I publicly do this in baptism, I'm burning bridges and cutting ties in ways that are very hard to do. Many of them won't do it because they have to then tell their parents, and the honor for their parents is great, and they are worried about that. I should have said this earlier, Dr. Bill Selvidge, who teaches missions at the seminary, is a member of my church and on my board, and he's helped us tremendously. They were missionaries in Hong Kong for 15 years. And I just go to him and say, I feel like I'm 5 steps behind. He said, for 15 years in Hong Kong, I was 5 steps behind. Because it seems like you have agreed on a strategy, and then no one's following the strategy. And so he's helped me to see that, and he's helped me to recognize how he sort of worked as a liaison too in the Chinese community to help alleviate some of the concerns or questions they may have. And the questions are nothing like the questions in the American congregation. Questions are, I did an introduction to the Church of the Nazarene class. Guy raised his hand. What is the connection between the government of the church and the government of the state? Because in China, that's a big deal. But here, and I said to him, there's no connection, and they don't believe me. They just can't conceive of that. So we've had that kind of stuff. I don't know that we've had, I mean, people get upset about small things and they blow it up into big things. So a Christmas program one year, the program bulletin was printed, and we printed it in Chinese and English. And we got a scathing email on Monday morning from somebody who was attending that said the only language that should be spoken in this country is English. And so, I mean, you still have that. And no matter how hard you work at helping them understand, but that's not how the gospel works, it's really inconceivable. And some people will just not accept it, and you have to be at peace with that.
We're making a similar shift in reaching the impoverished community.
Mm-hmm.
And part of where I'm wrestling now is, how do I change my preaching? How did you change your preaching more than 30% of your congregation?
This is the nightmare, man. I have PhDs in Bible and theology and philosophy, and I have PhDs and MDs who barely speak at a second or third grade level in English, and I've got to try to bridge that gap, plus kids, you know. And I don't know. I'm more anxious now than I've ever been about preaching, because it's so hard to hit it right. And I'm not totally certain if I have. What I landed on several years ago, my son is going to be a freshman in college next year in the fall. And when he was younger, and I've kind of, as he's grown up, I've tried to stay with him. I've tried to pinpoint the way I talk in my sermons so that he understands it. So I would quiz him. What did you hear me say? most of the time, he seemed to be able to tell me what the point was. But one Sunday, we were in the car going to lunch, and he had his Bible out, and he was reading really loud his Bible. And Becky and I, my wife and I, were talking in the front seat. And finally I said, Evan, your mom and I are trying to talk. What are you doing? He said, I'm reading my Bible. I said, well, why are you doing that right now? He said, because I don't have any idea what you were talking about this morning. And every once in a while, those reality checks are helpful to me to know that I've gone off. The folks that are well-educated in Bible and theology tend to recognize that the sermon has to come down to a level that reaches a lot of other people, so that's not really been too terrible. But I think I heard, maybe it was Dr. Warwick said last night, or maybe it was Dr. Noble said this morning, simple doesn't mean simplistic. So I'm not trying to preach a gospel that's just ridiculous. I'm trying to be faithful to the gospel. So doctrinal integrity is probably one of the highest priorities of my preaching, making sure I'm faithful to what we believe. And so I still try to do that, but I try to bring it down. And I know that, you know, probably half the time I'm still off, but, you know, I'm still trying. So, others of you, where are you serving? Are you in an area you're serving that has cultural challenges like this, or transformation in a community that may not be another culture outside of the United States, but a change in the community where your church is located? Is that kind of things some of you might be interested in? Because that is cultural shift, isn't it? So for the first time in the last 5 years, I have a fair number, it's still an overwhelming minority, but a fair number of what I would call blue-collar workers, people who are less well-educated. And always being mindful, the gospel has to be meaningful to everybody, so I have to think in terms of that and not picture. What I pictured this congregation when I first arrived was what I knew it to be when I left. And I was pretty close. It was pretty much the same. But, 10 years on, it was not at all like what I had come to know it as. Yes?
I think the confirmation, what you said, the realization that for congregation to shift into that ministry, it isn't a program that in 6 months you're going to have a turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
It's an investment that's you have to be faithful to the mission and the calling what you are.
Yes.
That congregation I was in the other 14 years, and we initiated mission of cultural change. So it took 6-7 years to eventually create that shift in that dynamic away from an attractional
mm-hmm.
church to a missional
right.
thing.
Yep.
And even when I left, not everybody was embracing of the, and ours wasn't a language deal. It was a economic, socioeconomic shift.
Correct.
In where we were ministering.
Right.
But yeah, there was still, after 14 years, just people going, we don't like this.
I learned that for some members of my congregation, the high water mark in the life of this church was when Millard Reed was its pastor. And that's what they measure everything by. And so if it doesn't look like that, they don't think anything's really happening. And, Millard was a fantastic communicator and a fantastic leader. And what he did to put this church going in the right direction was tremendous. But he came and spoke around our 40th anniversary. It was one of the... He didn't live very long after that, but he was strong enough to do it at that time. And Parkinson's had begun to set in with him. And he said to me, it's clear to me that you need to set an agenda that's different than the one I had. And I said, oh, tell me what you see. And so we began to talk. This was a drive to the airport with him to take him to the airport. And we began to talk about how he understood the congregation when he was there and what he sees now in the congregation. And it was really helpful for me to have the founding pastor sort of say, you need to chart the course now. And he said something to that effect publicly to those who were still thinking everything had to be the way he did it, that no, this is a new day and a new time. And those kind of things have been helpful along the way as well.